Join me Sunday at 4 for Folk Plus or on the WJFF archives.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, strategy shift. Due to the rapidly changing COVID-19 pandemic situation, Sullivan County is announcing strategic changes to balance the responsibility of protecting public health and enabling folks to go into schools and workplaces. We'll chat with Sullivan County Health and Family Services Commissioner John Little. Democracy in crisis. 6 in 10 Americans say U.S. democracy is in crisis as the big lie takes root. We're out in the community with local perspective about the future of our democracy. Eating Upstate contributor Aaron Shearer is back with a profile of The Dale, the cheeky pizzeria in Mountaindale, and a preview of our conversation with the chair of the Sullivan County Legislature, Rob Doherty, after a whirlwind week in county government. But first, the news from NPR.
8:20. Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Memorial services for former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid take place in Las Vegas this morning. The service will include President Biden and other Democratic Party leaders, as Yvette Fernandez reports from member station KNPR.
The Las Vegas Memorial Service honoring former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid will feature remarks by President Biden, Speaker of the House Pelosi, and Senate Majority Leader Schumer. Former President Barack Obama will deliver the eulogy. Held at the Smith Center for the Performing Arts, the service will also feature musical performances by Brandon Flowers from the band The Killers and singer-songwriter Carole King, a reflection of the senator's diverse taste in music. Senator Reeves' wife, Landra, said Harry loved every minute of his decades working with these leaders and the incredible things they accomplished together. For NPR News, I'm Yvette Fernandez in Las Vegas.
President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden flew into Las Vegas last night after touring wildfire damage in Colorado. Nearly 1,100 homes and other buildings were destroyed in the fire that's being called Colorado's most destructive on record. Some 35,000 people have been forced from their homes, and one person remains unaccounted for. Biden called the fire a code red climate warning. Air passengers remain on edge. They've been dealing with a slew of delays and cancellations since just before Christmas. Airlines blame a shortage of flight crews on the surge of infections driven largely by the Omicron variant, but the weather has also contributed to keeping planes on the ground. Heather Redfern is the spokesperson at the Philadelphia International Airport.
Bad weather across the country has been a major issue.
According to the flight tracking website FlightAware, more than 1,000 U.S. flights are among more than 2,900 that have been canceled globally so far today. In the Pacific Northwest, Friday snow and rain led to flooding and landslides. Authorities say at least one person is missing, swept away by floodwaters west of Olympia, Washington. State transportation officials say the mountain passes that connect western Washington to the east will likely remain closed through tomorrow because of avalanche danger. Stocks ended the first trading week of 2022 down, as NPR's David Gura reports.
The new year has not gotten off to a strong start for stocks, and shares of tech companies have been particularly hard hit. The Nasdaq closed down 4.7% for the week. On Wednesday, investors learned from the minutes of the Federal Reserve's most recent meeting in December that the central bank weighed raising interest rates sooner and more times than expected after inflation hit its highest level in nearly four decades. The latest data on consumer prices are due out next week. Investors also digested a disappointing employment report. In December, the U.S. economy added 199,000 jobs. That's way fewer than economists forecasted. But the unemployment rate ticked down to 3.9%. David Gura, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR. The Alabama Crimson Tide and the Georgia Bulldogs head to Indianapolis for Monday's National College Football Championship. Alabama Public Radio's Pat Duggins explains that the arrival was cut from 5 days prior to kickoff down to 3 to reduce exposure to COVID-19.
In addition to the threat from the coronavirus, Alabama head coach Nick Saban changed his approach to handle a young and inexperienced football team.
I felt like, just getting on these guys all the time, was not going to help their confidence. It was not going to help the young players develop.
Georgia head coach Kirby Smart says he wants to keep his team from dwelling on how Alabama beat the Bulldogs last month for the conference title.
You know, our focus has been on, okay, what can we get better at? Where can we turn our energy? Because it does no good to look backwards.
If either team gets COVID-19, the other could be declared the champs. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
The three-woman U.S. Olympic figure skating team is to be announced today, and last night Mariah Bell made the case for her inclusion at the Beijing Games. She's almost certain to be included after winning her first national title in 9 appearances at the U.S. Championships in Nashville, Tennessee. At the U.S. speed skating trials in Milwaukee, Brittany Bowe earned a third trip to the Olympics, setting a track record time in the women's 1,000 meters, and 17-year-old Jordan Stoltz is also going to the Beijing Games after setting a track record in the same men's event. Strong earthquakes shook western China early today. Authorities say 4 people were hurt and a tunnel was damaged, forcing the suspension of high-speed rail service in the region. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Yesterday, New York Governor Kathy Hochul said she is, quote, cautiously optimistic about COVID case trends that show a slowing rate of growth for the first time since the state reported its first confirmed case of the Omicron variant on December 2nd. The head of the CDC, meanwhile, said on the same day she doesn't think the United States has hit Omicron's peak yet. Locally in Sullivan County, due to these rapidly changing pandemic situation and the growing numbers, the county announced strategic changes to some policies. Health and Family Services Commissioner John Little said, quote, through this change in our response strategy, we aim to clarify and simplify the continually evolving guidance from the state and federal governments for Sullivan County residents. And to that end, there's even a flow chart to help you understand it. Joining us now, Health and Family Services Commissioner John Little. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for the opportunity to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. There certainly are conflicting and confusing and evolving guidance from all aspects. And you explained in the press release about these changes in the county that this is a, quote, fact-based, common-sense approach to our current situation, which will help everyone make decisions that protect their own health and that of the community as a whole, end quote. Why is the county pivoting now?
The biggest reason for the change right now is what we are seeing from the Omicron variant is so very different from what we've seen from the other variants previous in the pandemic. The Omicron variant is spreading like wildfire, frankly. But the good news is that for folks that have been getting vaccinated, it appears to be much less dangerous. Certainly, if you're vaccinated, you can get it. And folks that are vaccinated are getting the Omicron variant of COVID-19, but they have suffered, you know, mild to moderate symptoms, by and large, some even completely asymptomatic. And so the adjustment we're making is to account for that, which, you know, contact tracing in particular is very difficult to do when you're trying to chase contacts for, you know, thousands of people versus hundreds of people. So we're looking to reallocate our resources on that so that we can devote our limited time and talent to where we can make the most difference, which for us, we see as vaccination. Vaccination is our best way out of all this. And so that's where we're really trying to put as much of our effort as we can in conjunction with getting resources to everybody in the community to help them through the moment that we're in right now.
And we'll go through some of the changes point by point so people can understand it clearly. Sullivan County Public Health Director Nancy McGraw said that the number of cases, even though they're mild, is putting pressure on public health professionals and local healthcare providers. And that's a primary driver behind the changes in the response strategy. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just the sheer volume of cases that we're dealing with. And folks presenting themselves to the emergency department at Garnet Catskill, to their urgent cares, trying to figure out what they should be doing next. That has put a lot of pressure on the system. You know, the phone calls into Sullivan County Public Health, just responding to all those calls makes it difficult to do the contact tracing, which is, you know, again, why we're making these changes. But it's the volume is definitely a challenge for us, and we're looking to, you know, make sure that we are responsive to the public's concerns as we possibly can be. So that's, you know, as we lay out the changes here, that's that's why we're after it.
Okay, let's talk about the changes first. As you said, contact tracing. Now, starting Monday, January 10th, that's ending. You're going to discontinue COVID-19 contact tracing until otherwise directed by the New York State Department of Health.
That's right. And so the important thing for folks to remember there is just because contact tracing is ending doesn't mean that, you know, you're not going to be thinking about terms of isolation and quarantine. If you have symptoms of COVID, you should isolate yourself. If you think you've been exposed, you should try and get your hands on one of the at-home test kits that have been made available, or see a provider if you can, if you have the ability to get to one. So we still want folks to know, you know, where they're at and to keep their close contacts informed. But again, because of the sheer numbers of cases, we're going to discontinue that just because it's very hard to keep up with the number of folks that are sick and then all of their contacts. It makes for, you know, it takes a problem from hundreds to thousands to tens of thousands of phone calls to make. And at our level, at the state level, it just can't.
Oh.
Are healthier or at least are at less risk of severe disease, then we think that this is the right thing to do because we can reallocate our resources to other parts of prevention and protection of the public.
Okay. And those at-home test kits you mentioned, the county distributed a little over 3,300 of them to local municipalities. I think many of them are out of those, but they're more on the way. What's the guidance of what to do with those at-home test kits if somebody has obtained one either from the county or on their own?
So probably the first most important thing is make sure you follow the directions. These at-home test kits, they're not as sensitive as the PCR test that you would get in the doctor's office. But that's also, you know, because they're less sensitive, they're constructed in a way that you can get that rapid result. So folks need to think about, you know, when you take this test, if you think you've been exposed and you don't have any symptoms yet, there's a good chance that you would get a false negative from an over-the-counter test kit. But if you're starting to feel symptoms and you're not sure and you want to check, then those test kits are going to be pretty reliable. You definitely want to follow the directions on the package to make sure that you're doing things the right way. And then when you get that test, if you get a positive result, our local partners in the community, Garnet, Crystal Run, Middletown Medical, et cetera, because they are as busy as they are, they're recommending to folks that if you get a positive test result on your at-home over-the-counter kit, you should assume that you're positive and take the steps that that CDC and the Department of Health recommend. And then beyond that, we have, you know, the flow chart that you mentioned earlier, that is attached to our updated response strategy. And from there, folks are going to follow CDC guidelines. And for their isolation and quarantine letters, we're setting up a portal that will be available early next week so folks can put their test results into that portal that will generate their isolation and quarantine letters that have to now been a very personnel-intensive, man-in-the-loop process. We're going to automate that process to make that much quicker and easier with some guardrails in place to, you know, to protect from, you know, any kind of fraudulent or bad data coming in. But there'll be a system so that folks can get those letters generated automatically so they're not waiting so many days for state contact tracing to respond to them.
And another change, isolation and quarantine rules are changing. That is going to align with the federal CDC guidance. That starts on Monday as well, right? What are the changes there?
That's correct. So, and what folks have probably heard a lot about in the last few days in the national media is these changes that CDC has made from 10 days to 5 days. Again, we've created a flowchart to help folks understand how exactly this works for them. We've tried to keep it as simple as possible because it's hard for us to keep up with the changes that CDC and DOH are providing.
Yeah.
Even with the expertise that we do have, it's just been a lot very fast. I think the easiest way to explain it is that if you test positive, you're going to need to isolate for at least 5 days. Day zero of those 5 days is when you have an onset of symptoms or you get your positive test result back. If you're asymptomatic after 5 days, according to the CDC, you probably have lost your ability to spread the virus. You're not contagious anymore, right? So if you don't have symptoms after 5 days, you're going to continue to follow the CDC guidance. Sorry, let me back up a bit. I'm even getting tongue-tied over.
Yeah.
Asymptomatic after 5 days. You're going to be able to leave isolation as long as you're wearing a well-fitting mask. So a well-fitting mask is like a KN95, something that's going to fit snugly over your nose and make sure that you have good control of that. That's going to minimize that risk of further spread. But again, the CDC, with all of their data, has assessed that that risk of contagiousness and spread, continued spread, goes away after 5 days. That's a very low risk at that point. If you are moderately or severely immunocompromised, you're still going to continue to 10 days. Or if you still have symptoms after those first 5 days, you're going to continue to 10 days. And at the 10-day point, that's when CDC has said that your risk of spreading COVID to other folks is so minimal that it's safe to end isolation. So it's a 5-day. If you're feeling good and if you're asymptomatic, you can wear a well-fitting mask and reintegrate. But otherwise, you'll stay on for the full 10 days.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Sullivan County Health and Family Services Commissioner John Little about some of the strategic changes in the response to COVID-19 in the county. You said you're aiming to clarify and simplify, but as we just heard from the CDC, or as we've seen from the CDC, some of this is confusing. It's also spawned some memes, like CDC says you can dance if you want to, or CDC says my mom can drop us off if your mom can pick us up. I know not to make light of a situation like this, but is that why you felt like this flow chart would help with folks to understand, because it does sort of lay it all out in terms that are a little easier to understand?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, we went through the holiday period, and things changed so fast. The guidance from the CDC, and you know, by the way, I don't mean to criticize the CDC, with the rise of the Omicron variant in the United States, that has really changed, you know, what the data set that scientists are looking at. Omicron is very different from the Delta variant, so it's, you know, to our good fortune, it seems to be less severe, but it spreads much, much faster. So this has really forced CDC to really take a fresh look at the data that they're looking at. And so they've put more guidance out, and it does get complicated. So that's where the flowchart idea came from. And we put that together over the course of this week to release yesterday.
Yeah, CDC Director Walensky on the Today Show said yesterday that it is fast-moving science, and they're responding as rapidly as they can. In the county, you also are implementing, supporting local school districts who wish to implement test-to-stay programs in their districts. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. Test-to-stay is, the whole idea behind test-to-stay is it's a program that gives schools the opportunity to keep schools open as much as possible by, instead of kind of making blanket decisions to, say, a group of children, educators, staff, or were exposed and need to stay home, they can test the folks at school as long as they stay asymptomatic. Of course, anybody that is symptomatic would need to go home, but that's the idea, is you perform more surveillance in school against the disease so that folks that have low risk of getting symptoms have the ability to stay open. And you know, we've all seen, you know, from the battle days of the first wave, you know, the impact that this all has on our mental health, and the impact it has on the quality of our children's education. So, you know, we in Sullivan County, we want to support keeping kids in school, for the sake of their mental health, for the sake of their parents' mental health, for the sake of their education. So test to stay, now that we have enough kits to go around, the schools were provided with kits for every child that there was enrolled over the holiday break. We appreciate the governor's office and their support for that. And more kits are on the way. As you said earlier, we had 3,000 or so that we were able to get out to towns and villages around the county. We have 5,000 more on the way early this week, and we've ordered 20,000 more. So we think that we're going to be able to keep up test-to-stay program. That's going to give us a great opportunity to keep our schools open, keep the kids in the classrooms, which is going to be good for us all around.
And you're also in the county accepting $1 million offered by the state. That's part of an effort on the state level to support their indoor mask mandate. So what does that mean for the county? You're implementing a mask mandate?
Here's where we're at on the mask mandate, and I know this issue isn't without a lot of controversy. The mask mandate, the governor's office has offered $1 million per county for small counties, $2 million for the larger counties to implement the mask mandate around the state. The state has kind of acknowledge the reality of how difficult it is to enforce a mask mandate at this point in the pandemic. What we're going to be using that money for is to make sure that we're able to respond to the public where there are concerns with folks that are not masking up, with businesses that are having trouble implementing the mask mandate. We are not going to be the mask police, though. We are not going to be out issuing tickets, trying to put people in handcuffs over not wearing masks. What we're going to do is we're going to use this money to make sure that everybody is aware of the mask mandate, that masks are provided to folks and to businesses that might not have enough to be able to spare, and primarily, really, to promote vaccination. Because, again, that's what we see as the best way, the first best way for us to get out of the COVID predicament that we're all in. So we support the governor's goal, no doubt. We believe that masks do work. The science shows that. Certainly medical-grade masks have shown to be more effective than the cloth masks. But we also see that there's value there. The bottom line is we have $1 million opportunity to help out Sullivan County citizens and get more resources for them to help us get out of this pandemic. And that's why we decided to accept that money.
And again, there are some changes to the strategy, but the one thing that hasn't changed, and you've mentioned this several times, is that vaccinations are the most effective tool to help us get past this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, vaccines have been proven over and over again to be safe and effective for all age groups over the age of 5. And they don't prevent you from getting COVID. Vaccinations are not an on-off switch for disease. But what they have shown very reliably and in the data that we're seeing here locally and the data that CDC is seeing nationally is that COVID vaccines are very, very effective at preventing severe disease. And so for all the cases that we've seen, I mean, we've seen more than a 400% increase in the number of active cases versus the original COVID-19 surge in 2020. More than a 400% increase where we're at right now. But hospitalizations are roughly the same. So it shows you that the vaccines are definitely working for us.
When we started out the segment, I was mentioning the Governor Hochul's response to seeing some cautiously optimistic feelings about the trends. But then the head of CDC says she doesn't think the country as a whole has hit Omicron's peak yet. What are you seeing locally? What do you think?
I mean, we're definitely still climbing the curve. If what we've seen in the past is any indication of where we're at, I think we can kind of take a look at where the city is, where New York City is, and we tend to follow behind just because if a problem is more originating in the city, and I don't mean to, you know, cast aspersions on New York City, but because it's taking in at JFK, at Newark, at LaGuardia, you know, there's a lot of people coming in. And, you know, you can kind of see the ripple effects in the data that I've looked at least. Now, I'll caveat that I am not an epidemiologist. I'm not a public health expert. I'm just trying to help manage the emergency response here. But that is the trend that we have seen in the data in the past. So I would expect that we're not out of the woods yet in Sullivan County. We're going to continue to see increases for a little while. But the data that we've seen from other countries, South Africa in particular, where Omicron originated, is Dr. Lewinsky has said this at CDC, there's almost an ice pick type of a trend in the graph. So you see a very sharp increase and then a very steep drop off. So I think there's reason to believe that that's where we will head, but we are probably not at that peak yet.
And again, let's just review some of the changes in the response strategy at the county. Contract tracing will be ending on Monday. The isolation and quarantine rules are changing on Monday, reducing from 10 to 5 days and aligning with CDC guidance. Test-to-stay programs are arriving, and public health will be supporting those school districts who want to implement that. Implementing the mask mandate help accept that $1 million from the state and help to bolster support for the COVID-19 info line. Let's also review some of those resources like the info line that folks can get more information. So the info line number?
Yeah, the COVID-19 info line number is 845-513-2268. That puts you in contact with our public health nursing staff and the professionals, epidemiologists, et cetera, that support them. So they're a great local resource for where we're at in implementing our strategy and what folks need to do to take care of themselves and the rest of the community.
And also more information at sullivanny.us, including that flow chart, decision guide of if you test positive for COVID-19 or COVID exposure, helps you understand some of the steps that you should be taking. Mr. Little, before we let you go, you did mention this, you're managing an emergency. And I think that maybe some folks still don't remember that we're in a state of emergency. How are you and the rest of the team doing?
I feel good about where we are. We've been through a lot as a team. Folks are definitely tired, but the professionalism and the dedication to supporting the community is eye-watering. For all that we've been through, I love coming to work every day with people that are so dedicated to helping other people. So it's certainly tough. We've been through a lot, and to keep up with how fast things are changing has been stressful for us the last couple of weeks. But we feel good about the strategy that we're laying out, and we feel good about how we can keep at it in the future. We're strengthening. I mean, we've built good partnerships with local healthcare providers, and we're continuing to strengthen those. And we're also not, we're not letting ourselves be completely consumed by this. My deputy commissioner Wendy Brown, she does so much work to help folks with mental health, and particularly the drug problem that we have that is, really across the country been made more difficult by the isolation of COVID. So we have a very active drug task force that is working very hard, and all these different groups working together, social services, mental health, we're really trying to stay proactive and really create better conditions and improve the health of Sullivan County. So we're not just kind of on our heels responding. We're on the front foot, and we're really trying to make things better for folks. So it's tough, but we feel good about where we're headed.
Well, we certainly appreciate everything that all of you are doing to help protect the health of the entire community. We've been speaking with Health and Family Services Commissioner of Sullivan County, John Little, about the COVID-19 response shifts in the county. You can find more about those shifts and that flowchart at sullivanny.us. Commissioner Little, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tim. I appreciate it.
This is Radio Chatskill. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, a preview of our conversation with Chairman of the Sullivan County Legislature, Rob Doherty.
This music can reach further than we've ever imagined into worlds that have so little to do with our culture, the culture of Ashkenazi Jews. The music transcends. It takes hold. Someone hears it, falls in love with it. That's why I'm so happy to share this with you. I'm Aaron Bendich, and I play a selection of Jewish recordings on Borscht Beat on Radio Catskill.
Sunday afternoon at 1.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we spend the hour with the iconic Dr. Jessica B. Harris, author of High on the Hog and many other books. No one tells the story of how African food changed America and the world like her. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On Tuesday, District 1 legislator Rob Doherty was once again chosen by a 5-4 vote to continue serving as chairman of the Sullivan County Legislature. The vote came after a public protest against Doherty and current leadership. WJFF's Jason Dole spoke to Chairman Doherty for this coming Monday's local edition. Here's an excerpt of that conversation.
They stand up there, and, they're constantly, misinformed about topics. This ad is a prime example of this. Another thing they had in there, establish a 4% energy tax and argue against the full repeal. Hey, first of all, I didn't establish this. This went to a vote. It won by a 7-0 vote. Ira Steingart and Luis Alvarez was not present that day. But my point being is, to say that I established it just isn't true. We voted on it, and it passed 7-0. Every major vote that we have taken in this county has passed by supermajority. Mike McGuire was appointed as county attorney on a supermajority. The ACC was moved into the LDC on a supermajority, 8-1. We've picked the operator on a 7-2 vote. The Angie tax got, you know, instituted in a time that we had no idea where our revenues were going to go. We had no idea what was going on. The casino was shut down. The Cartwright was shut down. Restaurants were being shut down. People weren't moving around. You know, it was a crazy time, if you remember back then.
Yeah.
We had to make a decision to shore up our revenues. So, and we figured to pass it out to everyone, not just to the landowners. So when they sit there and they say, I'm not transparent, I'm not this, I'm not, everything passes on supermajorities.
Right. Right.
Everything.
So one of the things, we've only got a couple minutes left, and one of the things I wanted to talk about outside of the politics briefly was the developments at the county airport, because there's been a lot going on there the last couple of years. But within that, one of the most recent things that we heard right at the end of the year with the Hatzol Air signing the lease, like there was legislators on Tuesday saying that they were left in the dark on details of the contract with Hatzol Air. So, like, you know, that's the sort of thing that we hear. Like, how does that jibe with what you're saying about transparency?
Okay. So in September, you know, the legislature on a 9-0 vote voted to give me the authority to enter into a lease with the folks. You know, Mr. Perello is the head of the DPW committee. He had two meetings after that before the signing of the contract. He didn't bring the topic up one time. So at what point is it my job as the chairman of the whole legislature to inform committee chairs about things going on in their committee? At some point, you have to take some responsibility and understand what's going on in your committee, not reading your material, not asking questions. I mean, you don't have to come to, you know, this is 2022. You don't have to, you know, come into the building every day. You know, your phone works. You know, your emails work. I mean, ask questions. I do it all the time. I mean, you know, I'm constantly asking questions about stuff. I mean, you gave me the authority to do it. I did it.
Right. Well, Mr. Doherty, I appreciate you sharing your perspective on the politics at the county level here with us. And before we go, there is something that's outside of, you know, county politics that I wanted to talk about before we go, which was just because of the fact that right now COVID-19 is on the rise around the country. Here in Sullivan County, we've been seeing record high numbers of cases. Like, it's been weeks with day after day of me going on the radio saying these are the highest numbers that we've had for the whole pandemic. So I just would like to hear from you before we go about how the county is handling this surge, and what do you think we can expect in the short to midterm, the next few weeks and months?
So, you know, there's going to be a new protocol, you know, put out today by Nancy McGraw. I think Nancy McGraw and Public Health have done a fabulous job on this. They just handed out, you know, 3,300 test kits. They handed out, you know, tens of thousands of masks. We are going to be receiving some more masks and some more test kits very shortly, and we're going to, you know, keep on top of, you know, the, you know, keeping people masked, keeping them informed. You know, this isn't a joke. You know, I suggest to everyone to go get your vaccine. You don't want to get your vaccine. I understand that you have the right not to get your vaccine, but, you know, I'm vaccinated. You know, my children are vaccinated. I think that, you know, you should get your vaccines and, you know, do everything you can to avoid, you know, getting sick and getting other people sick.
It's an excerpt of Jason Dole's conversation with Sullivan County Legislative Chairman Rob Doherty. You can hear the full interview this Monday on the local edition at 6:30, right after All Things Considered. After a short break, local citizens speak up about the state of democracy. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Radio Chatskill, keeping you connected. Wearing a mask helps prevent the spread of COVID-19. And in New York State, masks are required in any indoor space that is not a private residence. The CDC recommends that immunocompromised individuals, those living in high transmission areas, and unvaccinated people should wear masks in indoor spaces. Help stop the spread of COVID-19. Wear a mask. Visit cdc.gov. Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.
I'm Donna Fellenberg, host of Catskill Character. Let's explore the Catskills together, meet amazing people, and hear their stories every Saturday morning at 11:30, right after Farm and Country. That's Catskill Character, Saturday morning at 11:30 on WJFF.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. 1 year after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, Americans are deeply pessimistic about the future of democracy, according to a new NPR Ipsos poll. It found that 64% of Americans believe U.S. democracy is, quote, in crisis and at the risk of failing. That sentiment is felt most acutely by Republicans. Two-thirds of GOP respondents agree with the verifiably false claim that voter fraud helped Joe Biden win the 2020 election. Overall, 70% of poll respondents agree the country is in crisis. WJFF's Rosie Starr took her mic to the Narrowsburg Union last month to ask local folks their perspective about the state of our democracy.
How are you feeling about the state of democracy right now? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I will say I am up in the air about it. I kind of keep to myself a little bit about everything going on, in a sense that I want to live in a world where everything is happy, peaceful, everyone's getting along, and we can all sit here and pursue our dreams.
And how are you feeling about democracy right now, the state of democracy?
You know, I stopped watching any form of news a little over 2 years ago, before the election. I just thought it was too fractious, and I thought it was just so negative, both sides, that I couldn't deal with it anymore. And there's times when I feel bad, like there was a disaster in Europe last year I didn't even know about. But on the other hand, I'm much happier.
Do you have any thoughts about democracy right now?
The nation can only get better, I would say. I'm not sure really what to think about all of this. I feel sad for this nation, because the United States used to be a great country, and I feel we slipped back a little bit. But hopefully in 2022 we'll come around again and people will start loving America and putting up their flags and go to a better year.
How do you feel about the state of democracy right now?
I think it's probably been a lot better at other times, but that's, you know, not necessarily a bad thing. It's time for people to get directly involved. People have a lot of passions and a lot of thoughts, but none of those really matter unless you get involved and get active. And I think a lot of people are joining the process now, and I don't think there's anything healthier for democracy than that.
I think democracy is one of these loaded words, that the content that you give it. I think democracy has to be more than periodic elections in a process that's mostly controlled by big money, in a system where the political structures are all reflect those interests and not those of the majority. So democracy, I always have to ask, for who and, you know, for what? Democracy for most people, I think, means having the rights and the freedoms and the political space to struggle for what's in our interests as the majority that work for a living, that don't just own or employ for a living.
In terms of thoughts on democracy, I feel I went to college during Watergate. And so I've been fairly engaged, politically speaking, my whole life. And I feel it's never been more important for every one of us to be engaged. Democracy is seriously under threat. I think we are in the vast majority who feel that, but are not possibly in the vast majority who really engage with that idea and try to keep our democracy vibrant and alive. And I've recently been more active in local politics, and just by not by running or anything, but just by looking at it and seeing the importance and how much people give up when they run for local office. That's a new sort of awareness for me, so I'm very appreciative of them. Looking ahead to 2022, you know, I think the news is generally so bad all the time. When we've made tremendous strides since Biden took office. Tremendous. Look what's happened in terms of vaccinating the country and getting money into people's households. I think it's just been tremendous. I hope that in 2022 we can confront the divisions that are really, I think, being perpetrated on us. I don't think those divisions naturally exist. I think they're being perpetrated on us. And so I think we need to find ways as a local community to confront some of the stuff that's going on in school boards. Why are we standing in the way of kids loving each other? I wish I had had that. I was in a very segregated part of the country, and I so wish I had had what is really available to people in Monticello and Livingston Manor and Liberty. I wish them all good luck.
How do you feel about democracy right now?
Yeah, I think that we shouldn't take that for granted. It's fragile. Just like relationships, you have to work at them. And I think that as a country, although we've been involved in wars, we have not had to make the sacrifices that forefathers have made and people in many other countries. So this is a test for us, a real test. It frightens me that we have become so fragmented. Yeah, I'm concerned. You know, very often when you surround yourselves with people of like thinking, you don't consider some things. I think the events of 2020, election and so forth, and since then, January 6th, should be a wake-up call to all of us that don't take democracy for granted.
Oh, gosh, it just seems like a blur. Every day is a new reality. We've been given such a great opportunity to really examine all that we're doing and to change it up for things that are more positive and more healthful for ourselves and our planet and our neighbors. I think it's been a great opportunity, and I hope we don't squander it.
How do you feel about democracy right now?
Oh, boy. I feel like we are in such a precarious place with democracy. And at times I feel powerless. At times I feel like forces beyond our control are pushing us in a very negative direction. And I remember that it really is about just neighbor to neighbor, keep our hearts open, keep in communication, keep loving. And that is the absolute best we can do. And we are not powerless. We can do that.
WJFF producer Rosie Starr out in the community gathering local voices about their opinions on the state of democracy. Thanks to Rosie for that. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
Here we come a-wassailing among the leaves a-green. Here we come a-wandering so fairly to be seen. Now is winter time, strangers travel far and near, and we wish you...
Winter was the season when country people used to sing to their apple trees to promote a good harvest. It's called wassailing, and there are some great wassail songs. We'll be hearing the best in the Wagaloda Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, Sunday afternoon at 3.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Erin Shearer is our new contributor who's back, and she's focusing on the upstate restaurant and food scene with a segment we call, appropriately enough, Eating Upstate. Today, she profiles the Italian restaurant in Mountain Dale called, appropriately enough, The Dale.
On today's segment of Eating Upstate, we look at The Dale, a casual pizzeria that opened in Mountain Dale in February of 2020, just before the pandemic shut everything down. Last June, The Dale was named by Eater New York as one of the best places to eat in the Western Catskills. The owner, Sarah Brancato, previously worked as a fashion and food publicist in New York, and its chef, Alex Wilson, has lived in the Catskills for more than a decade. Before selling his share in 2019, he owned and operated Wayside Cider, based out of Andes in Delaware County. The Dale's Pizza is informed and influenced by Alex's 2 years of living in Italy and Sarah's Italian-American upbringing on Staten Island. Both Sarah and Alex stress that they want to be part of the greater Mountain Dale community.
You're not just moving your concept from the city or another place and expecting it to work. Like, we really worked hard in kind of listening to people, what they wanted, what the pricing would be correct. And then Sarah is front of house and she does an amazing, she's just naturally good with people from all walks of life. And she's created, I think, an environment, and I think most people would say, where like everyone feels welcome. You know, it doesn't matter whether been here for three generations or you just came for the weekend.
As a child growing up on Staten Island, Sarah Brancato would help her father out in the kitchen and dreamed of one day opening up her own restaurant. She set those dreams aside to pursue a career in fashion, but after her brother suffered a stroke in 2015, she found herself in the position of having to take care of him, and she began to reconsider the idea.
I grew up in food with my father didn't do it full time or anything. He was working for a nonprofit and kind of a hopeless do-gooder, and he was kind of a local hero. However, when he came home from work, he would make elaborate meals every single day of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, didn't matter what day it was, what occasion it was. You know, we had a restaurant supplier delivering to the house, a separate freezer in the basement. He would go to the farmers markets and get everything local and, you know, just go above and beyond to get beautiful meals going. And I was his sous chef growing up. And so that's kind of the connection there. And then on top of that, he would also, you know, he did connect food with work by catering a lot himself on top of everything else he did. Him and I would tag team it and just really bring a beautiful experience to his beautiful functions, really. So that's also something that we did together.
She began traveling to the Catskills occasionally on the weekends, and on one of these trips, she met Alex Wilson, then the owner of Wayside Cider. They began a relationship, and by 2018, Sarah's brother was well enough that Sarah could relocate to Mountain Dale, a town that Alex had introduced her to. In Mountain Dale, she finally found the community she had longed for back when she was living in Brooklyn.
We met through mutual friends. So we were in a very similar friend circle. And it's like, I guess that's how I would sum it up. I mean, Alex, how would you sum it up?
We met at my cidery.
You know? Yeah, at Alex's cidery we met. And, you know, it was kind of serendipitous how it all happened. When we met, actually, was kind of the moment when I was introduced. He was the one who introduced me to Mountain Dale specifically. Because I was only, you know, I knew the Catskills, but Delaware County and other areas. But Alex is the one who kind of introduced me to Sullivan County. I, for the first time in a long time, fell in love with Sullivan County, almost like if it felt like home. So I grew up in Staten Island. I was born in Queens, lived in Brooklyn for over a decade. My parents are from Brooklyn, and my whole adult life, I've traveled because of work, and I was constantly, you know, moving to the point where, not moving as in moving, just like always moving, always traveling somewhere because of work and pleasure. And it was an ongoing joke. Friends would be like, where is Sarah now? Like, where is Waldo? And no one could find me. I was, you know, just couldn't stand still. And when I came to Sullivan County, it was the first time where I wanted to kind of my roots, like I wanted to ground myself. I've started to feel like, oh my gosh, I've traveled the world. I've been to all the boroughs now. And this is like, it felt like home. It felt like everyone I met felt like friends and family. And
what you said, it felt like Mountain Dale felt a little bit like old New York.
Old New York, like a lost borough almost.
Because there are so many people that have moved up. It's very multicultural, especially for the Catskills. It's like, I don't know if it's just around Mountain Dale or whether it's certain segments of Sullivan County, but it's like, it's extremely mixed, which is, I think, kind of unique for somewhere in the middle of the countryside, you know?
Yeah, like I felt a really extreme sense of community is something I've searched for my whole life because I grew up in a really beautiful community, and that's what I was searching for. I felt like I lost that in Brooklyn, especially traveling. And so when I came to Sullivan County, I felt more than ever and more more so in any of the parts of the Catskills that, okay, this is a real community that I can relate to, that feels like home and my family and friends, and I didn't look back, and I still feel great about the decision.
Before they opened the Dale, Alex and Sarah spent some time traveling to different parts of the country, gauging what kind of pizza they wanted to make.
I mean, I've always loved pizza. You know, I lived in Italy for 2 years, and it's like we would always go to the best pizzerias in every town. My boss was Italian and obsessed with going to the best gelateria and pizzeria. So, like, I had Roman pizza, Neapolitan pizza, you know, pizza from Puglia, from Milan. So I kind of had, you know, it wasn't like an intellectual interest in pizza. It was more just I really enjoyed it. When we first, you know, realized that it was going to be really difficult to get a chef up here, Sarah and I went to, like, the best pizzerias in North America and kind of came up with what we wanted. There's some people that are taking it uber scientific and, you know, very expensive and somewhat pretentious, and they're doing amazing things. I won't mention any pizzerias. And then there's other people that are trying to do a new spin on, like, the New York pie, or, and then you've got the sort of old establishments in, like, Connecticut doing the coal-fired ovens and everything else. And we just wanted to look at a range of stuff, but fairly quickly we realized that we liked, you know, we both had a love for Italian pizza, specifically, you know, Neapolitan pizza, but at the same time that wasn't really what we wanted. You know, we wanted to kind of blend the New York style, the better New York styles with a Neapolitan, sort of blend it. We found places like DeFaro in Brooklyn, which is, like, you know, been going, I don't know how many years, I imagine 35 odd years, completely unpretentious spot. And the guy's just got a formula that is amazing. Pretty much any day of the week, there's lines outside the shop. But, you know, it's an old baker's pride oven. It's not this bravado you get with a lot of pizzerias where they have, like, a wood-fired oven, but they don't really, not suggesting that no one knows how to use a wood-fired oven, but, like, a lot of people, they think equipment can kind of override skill and time and ingredients. You know, it's a nice centerpiece. It looks great. But we were more impressed by DeFaro with their, like, 1970s baker's pride oven, you know, at 600 degrees than we were in a lot of the places we went with, you know, 1,000 degree ovens and all the bells and whistles and fancy places. So, you know, DeFaro was a big influence, as was Badia's place in Philly was a real influence.
The Dale makes their pizza from a sourdough-based crust, which owes a debt to both Alex's previous life as a cider maker and his time spent in Italy, as well as Sarah's Italian-American upbringing. Growing up, Sarah loved the Italian food she made and ate at home with her family, but had a hard time with the pizza she'd eat out and wondered if she had had a sensitivity to gluten. With being exposed to sourdough-based crust, she realized that the sensitivity was to artificial yeasts.
You know, I didn't really know much about dough at all, and I just kind of, together, we kind of realized we wanted to do sourdough after a ton of testing. And then I realized, you know, the fermentation process is very similar to, like, a wild fermentation process in cider. It's basically, you know, at its most simple, yeast eating sugars, different kinds of sugars. So, yeah, like, I'm still learning all the time. But
I think something else that played a big role in the style and what we do, and we don't talk about this much, but marrying a beautiful pizza, but also having the fundamentals of really great ingredients that don't take a toll on your body. I have sensitivities. I don't speak about them, but, and I wouldn't call them gluten sensitivities, but I grew up not being able to eat a lot of starchy, like, pizza and pasta. And my family always used a sourdough. They didn't call it sourdough. They just always had a mother. My mom would always make homemade breads, and my Aunt Cecilia would make pizza and homemade pasta, my grandmother. And, you know, I never felt that kind of crash that you get from carbs. And, you know, Alex's formula of using raw honey and sourdough and organic flour from Utah is, you know, I always tell a lot of customers that don't have an allergy, like a bad allergy, like an actual celiac disease. If someone says, oh, do you have gluten-free options? I'd be like, well, tell me a little bit more about is it an allergy or is it just a sensitivity? And if it is, just, you know, try it out. Because for me, it was the first time and, you know, I was able to eat a pizza in this style that didn't completely floor me in terms of my body having a reaction and or eating it and then having like a carb crash. Whereas we eat this pizza all day long, not all day long, but every day we're open and, you know, we're not crashing. We don't get those effects. And probably it's not artificial
yeast
that, you know, we're using. And similar when we all travel to Europe, I hear a lot of customers and friends say, yeah, when I went to Germany or Italy, you know, I never feel that effect. And, you know, I had a similar experience in Germany where I can eat the bread there. I traveled a lot in Germany and I figured out quickly that it wasn't the bread or the gluten that was giving me these sensitivities. It was mainly the natural yeast that I would thrive and be able to eat. So I think that's just like another factor that also inspired us.
But if you're someone who doesn't like pizza, the Dale also serves salads made with local greens. They also host an open mic on Thursday nights where people from as far as New York City come to participate.
I think some people, they come into the Dale and the first thing they'll say is, we love the food, but we also equally love the vibe. And it fills both of us with joy and reminds us why we're here. Because I think it's sometimes so hard to be in a space and understand the environment. And we have open mics on Thursday and people like, this is the most magical night of the week. I mean, we have local artists, original songwriters all over, sometimes the city, sometimes Woodstock. And it's like, I don't feel like, yeah, sure. There's a certain curation that we personally do here, but it's absolutely not forced. And sometimes I feel like we're just an open vessel with our arms open, not forcing it, not controlling it, not putting a label on it, really just open arms, just saying, okay, this is who we are. And like, we're listening to you, like we're listening to the locals and we're listening to what they want and vice versa. And that's what I think the magic is. And having that balance, I think, is the key to success when opening a business, no matter where you are. Whereas I feel like a lot of times that's a challenge to some businesses that have an amazing concept and have these beautiful spots, but not really listening to where they're planting their business. And not to even toot our horn, I just think that that's one of the things that we've managed to do well, really. And it, like I said, it's not something we've controlled or forced.
It's like adapting to the environment.
It's adapting to the environment in the most organic way possible and just having an open heart.
The Dale is located at 4 Old Post Hill Road, Mountaindale. For more information, visit thedaleny.com. I'm Erin Shear. Eating Upstate is a production of WJFF Radio Catskill.
And that's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Wear a mask, stay safe, and thanks for listening.
Support comes from the Homestead School, Montessori education, preschool through early college with campuses in Glens Bay and Hurleyville. Building the intelligence, creativity, connection, and skills for an ecological future since 1978. Homesteadschool.com. From the River Reporter newspaper in Narrowsburg, New York. RiverReporter.com. And from listener donations at WJFFradio.org.
Recently on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Mo Rocca talked about the heartbreak of the latest COVID wave.
Yeah, you hear about somebody having a breakthrough and you think, good for you, and then it turns out it's an infection.
Yeah.
I'm Peter Sagal. On this week's show, we ask Woody Hobart, astronaut bound for the moon, if he's practicing what he's going to say when he lands, unlike that other guy. Join us for Wait, Wait from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill. This is Radio Catskill.
Public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
On air, online, on your smartphone, and on your smart speaker.
We are Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.
Farm and Country is coming up next. Today's forecast, sunshine high near 28, a wintry mix overnight, and freezing rain tomorrow morning.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. Damascus